And welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kellen McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. I started out my academic life as a historian of the Habsburg monarchy, but I teach in a small school, and I teach lots of classes, and I also have a growing, as you've noticed, growing interest in the history of mass violence. And all of that has meant that I've drifted away from that original field that I was interested in. And so it's a thrill today to talk to somebody whose primary interest is, in fact, the history of Hungary and its Jewish community and how that fits into the broader European context. Ferenc Lotzo is assistant professor of history at Maastricht University in the Netherlands. He's the author of three books, has edited three additional volumes, and has published a number of articles and essays. Today we're going to talk about his most recent book, Hungarian Jews in the Age of Genocide, An Intellectual History, 1929 to 1948. The book is a careful, concise, and powerful analysis of how Hungarian Jews responded to the traumas of the 1930s and 40s. Shows the complexity of the challenges facing them, that simply saying the 1930s and 40s may mislead more than it clarifies. I'm confident Ferenc can help us unpack the world his subjects were facing and why it matters, and so I'm really looking forward to talking to him. And Ferenc, welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on the show.
So I always ask people at the beginning to say a little bit about how they decided to become a professional studying, whether it's history or sociology and anthropology. So Ferenc, why did you decide to be a historian?
I should probably start by saying that I was born in the early 1980s, and both of my parents were researchers at the time. And so I went to a really good high school in the 1990s here in Budapest, where I'm from. And that was a really exciting time also for historical discussions. You know, there was a general opening of the country, and there was a lot of debate about the recent past. And Jewish history and the history of the Holocaust were very central to that, next to the history of communism, which just ended. So that was the time I was growing up, and that triggered my interest in history at a quite early age. At the same time, I should also say that I didn't really plan to be a historian when I was a teenager or so. I was at least equally interested in literature and in philosophy. And I did a BA degree, which was an interdisciplinary one. I studied the humanities rather than just history. So I really became a historian quite gradually over time. And I also found the topic I wanted to write my dissertation about, which is Hungarian Jewish intellectual history, as you just mentioned, really rather gradually. I started out wanting to write something about interwar Hungary and with a strong component on Jewish perspectives. And really, as I was getting into the material, I realized that there was really plenty of unexplored sources. So I basically sticked to this topic, and I explored it for a number of years, and that's how this monograph we are going to be discussed emerged. So that's the story in brief, I suppose.
So you got your degree at Central European University, and some of the members of the history department there are actually editors of the series in which this book is published. This is a school with a really interesting history. What's your experience like there?
The Central European University is really quite a special place. There isn't anything quite comparable to it, I would say. It's the only English language speaking university in Central and Eastern Europe where you really have students from all the major countries of the region, some of the best ones, I hope. and it's really an environment where there is an open dialogue about the recent past of this region, which, as you may know, is extremely complicated and also is very controversial in a great number of ways. And the CU, I think, has really managed, not only in history, but I think in history perhaps in particular, to position itself as, you know, a place where Western type of scholarship is being produced locally by people who know the Western academic tradition well enough, but are also, so to say, close enough to the sources and really know the countries they are studying very well. So I think that's really the combination that's quite specific to the CU. So I was very glad to be there. You know, I should also say I made a lot of friends. I think there's really been a really great atmosphere while I was studying there. And again, I was also, as you may know, I was also a researcher in Germany, so I am also somewhat familiar with the German tradition of studying the region. And I would say, you know, the CU is in some ways the place to study these countries precisely because it's sort of from within. And that's also very important to what I am doing as a historian.
Yeah, it's interesting. My students, I've just had to recently add a course in the to the course catalog here on the Cold War because my students don't realize it existed. It's now long enough ago that 1989 is something that their parents or possibly even their grandparents experienced, and that's here in the United States. And and perhaps we'll come back to this at the end of the interview, but I think the description you just offered would challenge my students because they don't understand that the kind of their sense of the complexity of European history is the first half of European history, not the second half, because that's what gets talked about in the United States. So why this book? Hungarian Jews in the Age of Genocide, 1929 to 1948. So you bracket the Second World War. Why did you decide to write this book in this way?
Right. So my dissertation really ended in early 44, so just before the major chapter of the Holocaust in Hungary. And I really focused on 29 to 43. And then I decided to expand the focus to also study the early post-war years, right, which was a very important decision. There is really a lot going on in scholarship around the Holocaust and especially around the Jewish responses to the Holocaust today, which mm-hmm. focus on the early post-war years. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, a new wave of studies showing that there really wasn't any silence when it comes to the Jewish communities of survivors. And I found Hungary to offer one of the richest source bases in this respect. This is what the second half of my book draws on. I found, you know, a huge collection of witness accounts. Mm-hmm. There were plenty of published memoirs in the immediate post-war month and years. And also there was an incipient historiography developing already in the late 1940s. So I wanted to focus on those as well. So I decided to expand my focus. But originally, this was really a project on the Horthy era, so the interwar years and the years of the Second World War in Hungary. And my basic idea was, and this is something quite well known internationally, I believe, that the Hungarian Jewish community was the last major Jewish community in the Nazi sphere of influence. As I mentioned, the major wave of deportations took place in the very late stages of the war. The Holocaust in Hungary has been labeled the last chapter of the Holocaust by Götz Ali and Christian Gerlach in their book, which was published in German under that title. Mm-hmm. And so my interest was really in what is happening in the Hungarian Jewish intellectual milieu in those years when they are already being persecuted and there were various forms of persecution, but the large majority of the community in Hungary is still alive until early 44, and they are heavily discriminated against by the Horthy regime, but still they have a hope of surviving the almost continent-wide mm-hmm. genocide. And they also had the chance to publish a number of journals and yearbooks, even during the years of the Second World War, all the way up until 1944. And this is really what triggered my interest. You know, nobody has really quite explored these publications previously. I thought that you could really study the evolution of Hungarian Jewish perspectives in a really new way by looking at them more closely.
So let's unpack some of what you said, because some of our listeners may not be completely familiar with the history of the Habsburg monarchy or its end. So you mentioned the name Horthy. Who is that?
So Miklós Horthy is the regent of Hungary who comes to power in 1919, right after the First World War. Hungary has a Republican regime for a short period of time. Then there's a Bolshevik takeover for 133 days. And Horthy is the leader of the counter-revolutionaries who then establish a kind of national conservative regime. It's an authoritarian mm-hmm. form of government with a very mild form of liberal tenets being incorporated into it, at least in the 1920s. And then this regime radicalizes ever further to the right, and it starts to discriminate its Jewish population ever more severely, again, starting in 1938 with the first anti-Jewish law. And it starts to adopt, in a way, Nazi-style legislation, you may say, by the early 1940s. In 1941, there's the infamous racial law. Mm-hmm. And even though the large majority of the community is alive until 44, there are several instances of mass violence committed against the Hungarian Jews before that. This is something I really want to emphasize, to balance what I said just before. Again, the Hungarian army is involved also in the genocidal campaign against Jews on the Eastern Front. There's also a first round of deportations from Hungary in 1941, in the very early on, just after the Nazi attack on the Soviet Union. And there's also mass violence in Vojvodina, in the northern Serbian parts that Hungary, so to say, re-annexes or reoccupies in 1941. So that's why I call, you know, these years the age of persecution, the years of persecution. I take the expression from Saul Friedlander, as many of the listeners will know. And I try to say that there's something similar going on in Hungary between 1938 and 1944 to Nazi Germany just a few years earlier. So, you know, if Friedlander is talking about the years 33 to 39, when he's using the term the years of persecution, I say that basically 5 years later, a very similar process is taking place in Hungary. It starts 5 years later. It lasts, in a way, 5 years longer. And then you have the years of extermination, which for Friedlander is basically everything that belongs to the years of the Second World War, right? All those 6 years. And in the case of Hungary, that's basically 44, 45. Mm-hmm. So the last year of the war, from March 44 till the liberation, you have the Holocaust, its main chapter. So that's how I conceptualized the study. That again, you know, concerns the Horthy era in this way.
Oh, so how big is the Jewish community in Hungary during this period?
Right. So this is again a very interesting question because by the late 1930s, you know, the five largest Jewish communities of Europe all live in what we now call, I think, Central Eastern Europe, right? Mm-hmm. It's the Polish one, the Soviet one, the Czechoslovak one, the Hungarian and the Romanian one. So these are the five largest Jewish communities in Europe. And this is something that I think hasn't really been quite reflected in the academic literature. I speak about that also in my conclusion, that if you look at Holocaust studies, there's a very notable shift to the east, right? There's ever more focus, right, not only on occupied Poland, which has always been there to some extent, but also increasingly the Soviet Union comes into view. But the fact that you know, Jewish history was very heavily concentrated in Central and Eastern Europe, and this doesn't only mean Poland, because again, Poland is I think quite exceptional, because there the attention has always been clearly there. I mean, that's something well recognized and well acknowledged also further west. But the other communities, you know, the Czechoslovak, the Hungarian, the Romanian, I think haven't been researched nearly as well as, for instance, the German or the Polish stories. So that's where also this book tries to make a contribution. And the Hungarian Jewish community, again, Hungary changes, as you may know, Hungary expands, so the territory changes between 1938 and 1941 four times. Hungary basically becomes nearly twice as large as it was after the First World War. Mm-hmm. And that means that the Hungarian Jewish community becomes one of the largest ones in Europe. It's really just right behind Romania at that time. And by 1943, and this is again also quite interesting, is the largest one west of the Soviet Union, right? So it's really the largest community still left alive in the Soviet sphere of influence. Now, again, you can take different indicators to discuss how many people there were, whether you take a religious definition or whether you want to, you know, look at the Nazis' racial definition to see how many people they wanted to persecute, you obviously end up with very different numbers, but it's in the range of 700 to 800,000 people just living within the borders of Hungary by 43. Again, something close to 10% of them pass away in violent ways before 1944. So that's a very large number. It's around 60,000 people, maybe slightly more. There's the numbers are not very exact here. Again, there's a lot of problems of calculation also deriving from the border changes, right? So people who may not have been Hungarian citizens before the Second World War nor afterwards may have been victims of the Holocaust in Hungary. So that is really a complicating factor there. We don't need to go into that too much here, I believe. But so it's really a major community. And another thing I wanted to maybe add as a last point, that also after the war, and this is, again, something crucial to understand why I talk about, 29 to 48 in my book. I say that also after the war, next to the French and the British communities, so the two major Jewish communities in Western Europe, is the Romanian and the Hungarian, which are the largest. Yeah. So, you have also quite a substantial community of survivors. Again, the large majority of Hungarian Jews are murdered in 44-45, but nonetheless, you also have quite a large number of survivors, in particular in Budapest. The Jews of Budapest mostly are not deported to the Nazi camps. And also you have camp survivors, Hungarian Jews being deported in the very late stages of the war, when also the Nazi camp system is being reorganized. They have, more survivors than they would otherwise have had, probably, right? I mean, this year of extermination is lasts, one year. And those who get transported further from Auschwitz have a certain chance, low chance, but certain chance survivors. So you also have quite a number of returnees from the camps who actually then end up, in some cases, coming back to Hungary, in other cases, going elsewhere after 45.
So as the Jewish writers who you study are thinking about the experience of persecution and the experience of living under the Horthy regime, at least one of the themes you discuss in your book is this attempt to understand whether the experience they're living through in the 30s is somehow a break, a pause in the kind of, I don't know, progress that Jews have made, or whether it's a permanent regression. So maybe you could talk about how do Jewish intellectuals kind of respond to this persecution in the 30s? And what kinds of things are they talking about? How are they viewing their past? What kind of policies are they debating?
Right. So again, this was really the major agenda in the first half of my book, to try to understand how the perspectives get transformed. What are the major themes that they are discussing? And, how and why this evolution of perspectives until 44. So that's, again, a very central question. And here is, I think, one aspect where, we've been talking about Hungary a lot and in a way, in a national frame until now, which is more or less what the book does. But it also does something slightly different or something more, which is to try to embed this history in a transnational
frame. Right, right.
And this is really crucial to understand my main argument, because what I try to say is that after 38, when Hungary starts to discriminate its Jewish population, and again, it adopts ever more severe anti-Jewish laws, so it's a legal form of discrimination. And there's, of course, a very severe process of socioeconomic exclusion leading to the large-scale ruin of the community by the early 40s. Hungarian Jews typically start to look for some kind of embedding of this crisis, of this tragic situation in Jewish history, right? Mm-hmm. They emphasize their Jewishness more than before. They are, of course, also, in a way, forced to do that, right? There are external constraints, external reasons why they would do that, but there are also people who simply are eager to find meaning in their Jewishness and endow their persecution with meaning via Jewish references. So this is what's happening until the early 40s, let's say 41 would be the key year here. And then, as I'm sure all your listeners will know well, the Nazis launch the genocide against European Jews. And that, again, changes their perspectives quite radically, because this is something that's happening practically all over Hungary, to some extent also within, if you look at the Vojvodina case, as I mentioned before. But essentially, it's something that's happening all over. You see, you have to, I think, remember that Hungary is directly neighboring Slovakia, right? The first country to deport its Jews northwards to Auschwitz. Hungary is, of course, also directly bordering the Nazis in the west with after the Anschluss of 38. Romania is, of course, heavily involved in the Holocaust early on, and so is Croatia. And, of course, Hungary is also part of the war on the Eastern Front. So, again, it's surrounded by countries who are part of the Axis, who are contributing to the Nazi war effort, and Hungary is as well. Now, this, of course, means that the situation of Jews is extremely difficult. They barely have alternatives. But one thing that they come up with is to try to emphasize, you know, their Hungarian affiliations. Yeah. So there is a revival of Hungarian affiliations in 42, 43. And my argument is that it's not in spite of the genocide, but rather because of it. You see, they know that the genocide is taking place all over the country, all over Europe, just outside the borders of the country. You see it happening pretty much more or less all over the place, and that is why they feel that, you know, the Horthy regime is now their last hope of survival, right? So you have again a revival of Hungarian national affiliations, national discourses of loyalism, and I would say that this goes a long way in explaining, you know, why the Hungarian Jewish elite is so loyal also in 44, right? This is a question that historians have been asking for many, many years. You know, this unfathomable loyalty of the Jewish elites to the Hungarian state, you know, the lack of rebellion, the lack of even an attempt to resist early on. And this is something that I think if you look at the logic, the dynamics of this story, you may come to understand it better, right? Because by 44, they really think Hungary is their only chance to survive. And of course, Hungary, the Hungarian state, betrays them in the most terrible way, and is, of course, very much involved in perpetrating the Holocaust in 44. But that is again what I'm trying to show.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things I found interesting was this debate about why all of this was happening. As I read it, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's something of a debate between perhaps religious scholars who say that one of the reasons is the drift away from faith and religious life, and those who have a more sociological or political explanation. How vibrant is that debate?
Right. So again, I try to define, you know, who are Hungarian Jewish authors, and this was again a very difficult thing to do, right? There's a lot of debate of who qualifies as a Hungarian Jew, and again you have a lot of contemporary scholars who debate that question. And my point was really to look at the internal sources, right? So one thing, and this is again a part of my introduction, I tried to say that these sources have been marginalized in Hungarian scholarship. I take a famous example for those who know Hungary will maybe have heard of it at least. Janusz Gyurgyák is an author who wrote a massive monograph on what he called the Jewish question in Hungary. So all the debates related to Jews in modern Hungarian history. And he basically said that, you know, the internal sources, so the sources that Jewish authors wrote with Jewish audiences in mind, do not really belong to this story. Now, this is something very, I think, strange, and something that I, of course, very much disagree with. And if you wish, the book is a product of trying to explain why and how I disagree with him on this issue. So I try to say, you know, that if you want to study Hungarian Jewish intellectual history, you have to basically look at all the Hungarian Jewish authors who, well, first of all, employ the Hungarian language in a prominent way to discuss Jewish themes, but also that they express a level of Jewish self-consciousness in the form of these Jewish intellectual projects, or at least they conceptualize parts of their own experiences as in important respects, specifically Jewish ones, right? So these are the criteria I use. And when I did this, of course, I wanted to arrive at a representative sample of intellectual phenomena, but also I didn't want to impose too strict group boundaries, right? I didn't mean to say that, you know, these people still qualify as Jewish and others don't or something like that. That was the last thing I would have wanted to do. But that then meant that I ended up looking a lot at, you know, religious people in the, in the strict sense of the word. So rabbis, also people affiliated with the main center of Jewish scholarship, the rabbinical seminary. But I also looked at intellectual journals, which were much more secular, right? So which you would consider something like an attempt to create modern Jewish culture in a secular key in Hungary. Again, I looked at people who were working very much at Jewish institutions like the Jewish Gymnasium or the Jewish Museum, which are, of course, they have a religious component, but they are essentially, I would call them secular kind of authors. So that is where this disagreement or this is where this mm-hmm. duality, mm-hmm. I think, comes from. If you look at chapter 2 and also 4, you know, most of the authors whom I'm studying there are rabbis. And if you look at, for instance, chapter 3, when I look at intellectual journals, there you will find a lot of people from all walks of life, right? People who often were brought together under the Jewish label for the first time in the years of persecution in Hungary. And it, of course, also has, as a last point, let me mention that this also has a gender component. Again, if you look at the chapters on the religious segment, you will not find women there, since this was the gender divide typical for this rather conservative form of Judaism in interwar and Second World War Hungary. While in the chapter on you know, intellectual periodicals from the time with a more secular agenda, you also find a number of female authors. Again, not too many. So it's, again, still quite a low percent, but there is that gender difference between these two groups.
Now, the other thing that struck me about the first half of this book is, as you say, the degree to which your subjects are really thinking transnationally, that the understanding and the degree of attention they paid to politics, particularly in Germany, but also other places, was impressive. And they actually knew quite a bit about what was happening in Germany.
Absolutely, yes.
They and I think I'm right. There's actually an author, and I've forgotten his name, who pens quite a insightful report in, I think, 42 about and laying out actually the claim that, although I don't think he used the word genocide, that what was going on was in fact something different than had ever happened before.
Exactly. Yes.
Well, let's turn. So you've talked about 1944 a lot. Maybe I could ask you briefly to just kind of give us the chronology in 1944, because this is going to bear on some of the things you talk about in the second half of the book. So what happens in 1944?
Mm-hmm. Right. There is, as you can, I think, as all the listeners can probably well imagined by now, there isn't any question which is more controversial than that. In Hungary, that's also, again, the big debate today. You know, what are the causes of the Holocaust in Hungary, right? Why do the large majority of Hungarian Jews get deported in such a short period of time, so close to the end of the war? Right? That's again, something that is very heavily discussed, partly because for a very long time, the idea was that this is due to the German occupation of the country, right? That Germany, which is, again, an ally, Nazi Germany is an ally of Hungary, and the Hungarians are in many ways profiting from that alliance relatively early on, right? I mentioned the territorial expansion in the late 30s, early 40s. Germany decides to invade or to enter Hungary in early 44 on March 19th. It doesn't really encounter a significant amount of resistance. It's really an occupation by an ally, if that is not a contradiction in terms. They are really working together. And then the Holocaust in Hungary follows very, very soon, right? The deportations again start within 2 months. And they also are at an unprecedented speed. That's something that's very often emphasized by scholars of the Holocaust in Hungary, that within 2 months, then a very large majority of Hungarian Jews get deported. Over 400,000 people arrive in Auschwitz-Birkenau between May and July 44. And then the question really is, what is the connection, right? So how did this German entry into the country influence the decision-making process, or was it really chiefly responsible for what happened, right? Mm-hmm. And I think many scholars in recent years, and by now already decades, I would say, have very much insisted that this so-called German occupation doesn't quite explain what happens. It's not the primary reason. There's something really different. It's really the change of behavior on the Hungarian side that would explain what happens. It's really the Hungarians, you know, the people who want to commit this genocide see a great opportunity in this entry of the Nazi army and the Nazi forces of persecution to some extent. I mean, of course, Eichmann, as you know, infamously also comes to Budapest, and they have a certain plan, but it's really the Hungarian side which pushes for a more maximalist implementation of the plan. There's a lot of new literature also on the interaction of the two sides, some of which shows, I think, quite clearly that some of the Hungarian perpetrators, such as László Endre, was actually even more radical than the Nazis. He had a greater urge to deport Hungarian Jews, and he actually negotiated for more people to be deported at a faster pace, since the end of the war was nearing, and he thought that this was the way to still implement the genocidal plans. So again, that is the story in a nutshell. And then there's another element which I think is quite important to clarify, which is about the fall of 1944, when the Hungarian fascists, or the Hungarian Nazis, you may call them, again, the labels are contested, come to power. But it's only, this is the Arrow Cross movement led by Ferenc Szálasi. But this is, again, after the major chapter, right? The major phase of deportation still take place under the Stojai government, and when Horthy is still in power in many ways. I mean, he's still, in that sense, directly responsible for these events as the regent of the country. And then you have a turn to the Arrow Cross movement, again, put in power by the Nazis, through a putsch in the middle of October, and they continue persecuting and murdering Hungarian Jews until early 45. But again, the major chapter is before the fascist takeover. This is something that I wanted to mention, because I think it's often mistaken in international scholarship. There's often an assumption that the worst must have happened under the fascists, and that these fascists were somehow puppets of Nazi Germany. And of course, this is an argument that also in Hungary has often been used, right? That the Holocaust was essentially a result of the fascists' actions, who were then very much helped by the Nazis, and therefore the actual Hungarian responsibility would be somehow of a lesser kind. But in fact, if you look at the story a bit more closely, you realize that it's in many ways the interwar establishment that commits the crimes, and it's not just the right wing fringe which would be involved.
So you mentioned before the kind of traditional historiography, which has argued that there was this period of silence about the Holocaust, and that period of silence ended in the 60s and 70s, and various explanations as to why that might be so. And then you mentioned this, and so I guess I'd like now just briefly to ask you to expand on what you mentioned earlier about the emerging, I don't know if you can call it consensus, but the emerging sense that interpretation isn't really correct, that there wasn't this moment of silence, that Jews were talking about their experiences immediately after the war. How did we decide that actually happened?
Right. I think that's a very, very interesting question, because what I think happens is that people who establish a Holocaust scholarship later on don't really talk about their predecessors too much. So you have a sense that, when Raoul Hilberg, for instance, publishes his groundbreaking monograph, he's not really emphasizing too much that there were people who have been writing about this topic or who may have published about the topic already right after the war. So there is certainly this early wave of responses, which then gets largely forgotten and gets to be largely marginalized. And I think it's only in more recent years that scholars have started to focus on this. Now, again, Laura Jokusz, who's a German scholar currently working in Israel, has written, I think, a terrific book called Collect and Record. And she has really studied some of the major cases. It's some kind of European panorama that she provides about all the documentation centers and historical commissions that were studying the Holocaust right after the war. Her major focuses are Poland and France, but she also studies Austria, Germany, and Italy. But she doesn't really talk much about Hungary, which is, again, of course, understandable to some extent. But my point is that Hungary also had such a wave, and it, in fact, was one of the largest waves anywhere in Europe for some of the reasons that I mentioned early on. So it's, I think, next to France and Poland, it's really in Hungary that you have the largest corpus of sources to really prove this thesis, right? That there was never really silence. And here, again, I wanted to maybe draw on David Cesarani's point, who tragically passed away just last year, who mentions that even if we discard, this what he calls the myth of silence, we still have to take into account that there was a deafness of the surrounding world. Yeah. So many people don't really listen to the survivors, and there are very, very few non-Jewish people who would be interested in these stories. So it really, in a way, remains a Jewish intellectual history, like I study in my book. And it's also only a generation or two later that you have finally something like a connecting community, right? That's how Mary Fulbrook labels it in her recent research, that then there are suddenly people all around the world who want to find out more about these stories of survivors and who are really interested in them in a very empathic way. And this isn't the case early on. So again, while I emphasize that there is a major wave of responses in Hungary, this very much is an affair of the community of survivors, tragically enough, once again.
So one of the source sets of sources you find is a whole collection of interviews, which sound fascinating. Who's collecting these interviews and why?
Right, that's a very interesting question. Again, Hungary has it's a special situation, partly because, as I mentioned, there are two groups of survivors, people who survived the Holocaust in Hungary and people who were deported to the Nazi camps but managed to survive and managed to then also return to their country of origin. And these two groups of people meet around 1945. So those people who are receiving people back, they are starting to inquire with them, what they had experienced. And this starts out in a very simple way. They want them to also list, just very simply list people they know would be still alive, but somewhere abroad, as they see it, right? So somewhere outside Hungary, and also to list people they know to have been murdered. So they want to basically compile lists of the victims and lists of people they should still be looking for. This is how it starts. And then as time passes, and again, you have thousands and thousands of survivors returning, asking for help. And while they are asking for help to reintegrate somehow or to reestablish themselves in Hungary in the early post-war month, they start interviewing them. And again, this is, I would say, a semi-professional project because they also develop an extremely long questionnaire of some, 14 pages, which they cannot quite apply, right? This is a massive questionnaire, which would then mean that you would have to talk to everybody for hours and hours. So instead of doing that, they just end up basically adjusting the interview. So the people who make the interviews, and there are altogether 29 of them, and most of them are women. This is again an important quality of the interviews. I would suggest they make them in quite unique ways. I mean, right? Every interviewer makes a different kind of interview, but they talk to altogether more than 5,000 people. Again, there's like 3,600 interviews that I had the chance to look at, and there are some of them where there's more than one person speaking. The large majority of these are in Hungarian. Some of them, and I think up to 20% or so, are in German. So there is also, in that way, access for those who may not know the rather idiosyncratic Hungarian language. but the point is that here you have, again, a attempt at documentation, right? Many of the things that we assume you would want to know when you talk to a survivor or you would want to sort of talk about, they don't yet really have. Their interest is in many ways in historical documentation, I would say, and that's also what I tried to then study. So, you know, if they wanted to document the Holocaust, what have they actually documented? You know, what were the linguistic codes? What were the key terms that they then used to denote, you know, what was so unprecedented about the Nazi genocide against European Jews? And that's basically what the core part of this chapter on these interviews is. So I basically look at perhaps above all distinctions between different camps, you know, how different nomenclature is being used and how these differences are then explained during these interviews. So that's something I was very, very interested in, you know, how could survivors explain in a way about the Holocaust as a whole. And my conclusion is, and this might be very surprising in our age when, you know, we look at, I think, memories more for their subjective value, that actually these interviews have a lot of historical value as well. So again, as a historian, this is really a very impressive project of documentation that takes place via the survivors in 45-46.
Yeah, one of the things I found most interesting about your discussion is the, at least as I saw it, a sense in which some of the tropes and some of the kinds of language we now use were already widely established and used, but in other ways they're scrambling to come up with a language that can describe what they felt and experienced. You also use memoirs. Seven, I think, if I've got that right.
Yes, yes.
Some by Jews, some by not, some not by Jews. They display some interesting differences. Can you talk about, maybe the place to start is just to say they seem to date the start of the catastrophe differently.
That's right, yes. So this again relates to something we have been sort of discussing earlier on with the controversy around 44. And I studied the memoirs, and again, I picked seven of them. And this is the only part of the book where I draw on so-called non-Jewish sources, right? Because I wanted to compare and contrast them. I look at memoirs published in 45-46, so around the same time that these interviews were made that we have just been discussing. And I wanted to see how they look at 44-45. So, you know, what I call the year of extermination in Hungarian history, 44-45, how were these experiences, these events interpreted in the immediate aftermath? This was my question. And then, you know, I knew somehow that they would be interpreted very, very differently by different people. This probably isn't too surprising. But what I wanted to look at specifically is how do different groups of persecuted people who really, you know, claim to have just been persecuted, how do they narrate these events and how do they endow them with some kind of meaning, you know, political, historical, or otherwise? And what I have found, and this is, again, I think, an interesting point also when you look at the discussions in Hungary today, is that it's the anti-fascists who introduce the idea of March 19th, 1944 in a very, very significant way. So what we know today, as you know, the right-wing attempt to in a way shift the responsibility onto the German side, right, to emphasize the German occupation, this is really very heavily emphasized in their anti-fascist narratives, right? For them, you know, the turn to fascism and then to the beginning of their persecution is March 19th. And this again coincides very closely to their own life experience, because many of them were, you know, captured by the Gestapo immediately upon the entry of Nazi Germany into Hungary. And they were the first, you know, to be then persecuted. And because of that, they have also missed out on, in many ways, they have missed out on the persecution of Hungarian Jews. Right. So then if they survive and when they then return to Hungary and become politically quite influential, at least many of the people I study then here have had a certain political role in the post-war era. they also develop something like ethnicist anti-fascism. I call it that way, and I say, you know, this ethnicism is really consists of two major components, right? The one is to overemphasize the German occupation as a breakpoint, as a kind of rupture in Hungarian history. And the second is to then not to really emphasize the Hungarian perpetrator role too much. So in that sense, you know, they can be anti-fascists by seeing the Germans as the perpetrators and the Hungarians as victims. So this is what I'm trying to show. And in that way, you know, they also have a much more directly political interpretation of 44, 45. And if you look at then all the Jewish memoirists, and there's really a lot of them immediately after the end of the war, but they are much, much more diverse. So if the anti-fascist non-Jewish narrative, you know, in a way, happens to be quite stable and happens to be quite homogeneous in many ways, the Jewish memoirists write about their experiences in very, very diverse ways, and very often they don't find any clear political meaning. Right? It's more the accidental survival of them that they are somehow inquiring about.
So you also, I guess the last group of kind of sources you talk about are attempts to create some kind of historical narrative about the experiences there, right? People who are writing what we would call histories. And I was surprised, maybe that word's not strong enough, by the degree to which there were people who were doing primary resource, publishing source documents, doing kind of what we would think of as traditional academic writing. So maybe you could say something about what kind of interpretive frames did they come up with for the Holocaust?
Yes. So again, my last chapter is on four people who have written histories, published them in 47, 48, and they interpret the events in quite different ways. So I also try to, again, compare the perspectives. It's absolutely true what you have just said, that there's a lot of research going on, and some of this research, again, draws on the knowledge that was there before 44. Mm-hmm. So again, this continuity that I emphasize in intellectual historical terms is also important, because some of the people who write, you know, these early histories of the Holocaust were people who were already studying Nazism, studying, you know, the persecution of Jews before the major chapter of the Holocaust in Hungary. So again, that is a precondition for why they could launch these projects so early and, you know, complete them already before the Stalinization of Hungary. And again, there are four of them that I study. Their names are Samuel Löwinger, Ernő Munkácsy, Jenő Lévai, and Endre Sós. And they all have a slightly different take, or you might say very different take. Samuel Löwinger is a scholar of religion. He's the director of the Rabbinical Seminary in the 1940s. And he basically looks at the history of religion and how there is a German tradition of trying to deny the influence of Jews on Christianity, to create a kind of new purified Germanic form of Christianity, and that this then leads to what is the genocidal agenda against Jews, or this is sort of the intellectual historical origins of the persecution. You may say, and again, I don't mean to stretch the analogy too far, but Alan Confino, in his new book, A World Without Jews, does something comparable, again, on a probably more higher and more sophisticated level. But Löwinger's agenda is, I think, in many ways in line with Confino's recent book. Now, Munkácsy is a very interesting case, and we're just going to publish his book in English next year. So I'm very glad to say that, because, again, much of the material I discuss in this book is not available in English or in any other language than Hungarian. So that's fortunately something that's going to at least slightly change in the near future. And Munkácsy was the chief secretary of the Jewish Council in 44. So he's somebody who's also accused of having collaborated with the Nazis. There's a lot of criticism of the leadership. And he writes a rather apologetic book, which is, again, there to explain, you know, how they made their choices and why they acted the way they did. And in that way, he writes a history of the Holocaust from the perspective of the persecuted, or the leadership of the persecuted, more precisely, which draws very heavily on Jewish documentation, on Jewish sources. Again, interestingly enough, of course, these are sources that he himself helped co-produce, right? As a chief secretary, he was very much there to produce some of these sources. So again, that's a very, very interesting case. And again, I wrote a long introductory essay for the translation of that book, which will be published next year. Now, Levi is the major researcher, the third person I wanted to say a few words about. He's the one to publish altogether 12 books by 1948. He's really incredibly productive in these early post-war years. He's a journalist by profession. And of course, he's used to writing a lot, partly because of that. But he's the one to really, in a way, grapple with the question of responsibility the most. You know, his different books from these few years shift the emphasis quite a lot, and he comes to articulate the Hungarian responsibility, I think, ever more clearly as the years progress. Early on, he has a very clearly anti-German, almost ethnicist way of you know, blaming the Germans for everything. And by the late 40s, in his major synthesis called Jewish Fate in Hungary, he comes to, I think, a very balanced and quite precise assessment also of Hungarian responsibility. Sure. Now, András Sosem, he's the fourth author. He's really a communist by this time. You know, he gets converted to the communist ideology, partly through the experience of the Holocaust. And he writes an all-European panorama. So again, if Munkácsy and Levai, the other two authors, are really focusing on Hungary, Sós is the first one in Hungarian to talk about the genocide against Jews in an all-European frame. And he again already uses the word genocide. He's discussing it, how to translate that term into Hungarian. There isn't yet an established translation for it. So he's suggesting a number of alternatives. And he's, again, as a communist, he has a very strongly, so to say, ideological Marxist reading of the economic causes of the Nazi violence. So again, the four of them all offer very different perspectives, I would say. You know, one religious, the other from the community elite, the third one a kind of left-leaning critical researcher, and the fourth one a very ideologically kind of biased communist, right? So you have basically a whole spectrum of interpretations. And I argue, and this is again my melancholy conclusion in the chapter, that there has never been a more diverse, you know, debate about the Holocaust in Hungary. You know, if you look at this moment in 47, 48, there isn't anything quite comparable to that today in terms of the variety and also the richness of research and really the monographic output of the.
That's actually where I wanted to go next. So what happens to these debates after 1948?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that is, again, a fascinating question. There is really an abrupt break because of Stalinism, right? The debate gets suppressed. The transnational perspective shows us that the decline of interest also within the Jewish communities happens more or less parallelly also in Western Europe. So if you look at France, the CDGC, and this is again something that Jokus, I think, shows very nicely, the interest in the topic declines around the same time, the late 40s, early 50s. There's clearly less interest in continuing this very, very intense, very, very, you know, lively and very, you know, painful discussion about what has just happened. And in Hungary, it's really after 56 that the Holocaust as a topic returns. And again, here I want to emphasize one thing which may not be known that well. It's really in the case of Hungary where the large majority of the victims of the Second World War, or we may say the Second World War and the Holocaust, are Jewish, right? In most European countries, if you look at the overall numbers, you know, in percentage-wise, the Jews were murdered in much larger numbers than non-Jews in most countries. But it's only in Hungary and a very few other cases, and I think Hungary is the most extreme case, where really the absolute majority of the victims are victims of the Holocaust, right, who were murdered during the war. So again, it's a very central story in the country's history, or at least should be that. So when the discussion is relaunched, there's again quite a great interest. And this is what you see already in the late 50s, but especially then later on in the 70s. Again, Hungary is quite in line with the new interest in the Holocaust at that time. This often takes literary form, though. So again, historiography is lagging behind. And historiography, I would say, is lagging behind all the way until 89 and maybe even beyond. Because until 89, the most important works, and here Randolph Graham's name comes immediately to mind, the most important works are written abroad, right? So are written in emigration by people in the U.S. or in some cases in Israel. And there isn't really research on the Holocaust in Hungary, which would then have international relevance. There is a number of documentation projects and so on, but it does seem very meager in comparison to what we had just after the war, right? So again, it's in that sense, I think it's 89 that is the big breaking point, right? There's suddenly a huge wave of interest. If you look at my introductory chapter and what kind of literature I refer to there, you will probably quickly notice that a lot of it is from the 1990s. You know, we started the interview by me saying that I went to high school at that time, and that's when my interest was triggered in these discussions. And that's really when the discussion is, again, reaching some kind of a peak. Exactly. Already in 89, 1990, there are a number of publications, but later on, ever more. And this is that then leads to what I would call a massive politicization of this history. So if I wanted to be very brief about, in a way, the current situation, I don't know whether you wanted to ask about that too. So again, if I wanted to highlight just one thing about that, I would say that this is the problem of a national narrative developing after the fall of communism, which is a national narrative focused on victimhood, focused on also the victimhood of the Hungarian, you know, national community, and how this new mainstream narrative, which is again being institutionalized in a great number of ways, how it can then cope with a very different type of story, which is the persecution and extermination of Hungarian Jewry, with again a very significant and very crucial, in fact, crucial involvement of Hungarian perpetrators. So you have that situation, and this makes the history of the Holocaust a very polarizing topic in Hungarian politics and culture until today. You have no clear sense of its status, and I think we still are in a way grappling with, you know, how to incorporate it and how to really talk about it in a larger framework, which is again very nationalistic and therefore is in many ways unready to accept Hungarian responsibility for such a major crime.
So it's a fascinating discussion, and it's a wonderful book, and I'd love to talk about it with you more, but I know you have things to do, and I appreciate the time. I always conclude interviews with the same couple questions, and so the first one is, you've clearly done a lot of reading and research on this. Maybe you can suggest a book or two or a movie or something that my listeners or me maybe might read this weekend. What was meaningful for you as you worked on this project?
You see, I think I have, in a way, uncovered a lot of materials which which are worth looking into, and very little of this is available internationally.
Right.
So I'll probably suggest something that has been translated into a number of languages, including English, and that is Béla Zsolt's Nine Suitcases. It's one of the early memoirs, which I actually don't discuss in the book. So, you know, it in a way goes beyond the scope of this modest study of memoirs, which I offer in chapter 5. It's a fascinating book written by a leading journalist, politician of a, let's say, left-leaning liberal persuasion, who survived the Holocaust, was also in one of the most gruesome ghettos in Oradea, Nagyvárad, and was also as a labor serviceman on the Eastern Front. And he describes his experiences, I think, with a lot of black humor. It's a very grim book as well. It's a very honest book, very, in a way, brutal. But I think what he does there, and again, this is something written immediately after the end of the war, reflects, I think, very well what these early responses more generally feel like. You see, when I also study the witness accounts, I think there's a lot more direct evidence in them than in some of the later ones, right? People become more cautious, people become more sensitive about things, more, you know, also eager to maybe avoid some of the worst of the horrors. And this is not so much there early on. And I think Béla Zsolt's book 9, Suitcases, reflects that very well. And he's also a very, very interesting writer, a very, you know, conflicted personality. So I think the book is very, very exciting to read also today. And also if you want to get a sense of the kind of materials I was dealing with in this book.
Well, we're taping this just before, or just as I'm starting my holiday break. And I'm at a Catholic school, and so we get a lengthy Christmas break. And
yes,
it does seem appropriate to the subject we study that I am now going on Amazon and ordering 9 suitcases so I can spend my holiday break reading about the Holocaust. And then the last question is always, what are you working on now? And I know one of the things you're working on is being a new parent, but I also know you're an academic. So what kind of research are you exploring in the future?
Mm-hmm. Right. So as I started with saying that I'm a historian of Jewish history, but I'm also a historian of modern and contemporary European history. My job profile is in modern and contemporary European history. And I do want to write a next book, which is more contemporary and which is also more a regional history of Central and Eastern Europe. I'm trying to write a history of the transition period, and I'm particularly interested in something that I think gets debated a lot these days, which is, you know, why the liberal consensus that these countries had after the fall of communism disappeared by now. So again, if you look at Poland, or also if you look at Hungary, and maybe even more conspicuously Russia, it's clear that there is a turn to a more authoritarian, more nationalistic, politics. And I'm trying to understand the roots of both. You know, how could these countries develop in a much more liberal direction around 89 than before? And what are the reasons why now you seem to see this backlash against that? So this is my current interest. I hope to have a monograph about that in a number of years. Again, as you correctly mentioned, I'm a young parent, so I might take slightly longer this time. but I have I think a few years to work on this. So this is it. And again, it's something that where I'm really struggling today, also because of the very recent events in the Western world. Mm-hmm. I must say that in some ways it makes my research all the more relevant for Western audiences, perhaps. But it also means that I should probably expand my focus, because the crisis of liberalism is really a topic that is not heavily debated in the U.S. and also in the U.K., right? Countries which we teach also in our courses as role models for liberal development in modern times, right? I mean, in particular, we teach British history in that manner at my university in Maastricht. And that is something that, again, doesn't quite square with the experiences of our students who are now 19, 20 years old coming to do a BA. So there's something to I think, debate there too, for sure. And I might want to, you know, expand the scope beyond Central and Eastern Europe, where, you know, again, my primary focus is and where my primary expertise is.
Well, it's a great project, and it's an important question. And I hope that when you've got an answer, and I appreciate the political skill with which you used the phrase "a number of years." As a department chair, I understand how this works, but I hope you'll be back on the show to talk about your book when you're done.
Well, I would be most grateful if I had the chance again.
So thank you so much. Have a wonderful holiday season, and thanks again for being on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Thank you to you, and to the same to you. Thanks.
You've been listening to an interview with Ferenc Lezo about his new book, Hungarian Jews in the Age of Genocide, in Intellectual History, 1929 to 1948. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll join us next time when I'll interview Ed Westerman about his book, Hitler's Ostkrieg and the Indian Wars, Comparing Genocide and Conquest. Until then, thanks for the download and have a great month.